Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. On today's episode, I sit down with Caroline Calloway. She is a writer, artist, influencer, and self-declared scammer. She first became internet famous for diaristic captions chronicling her adventures as an American undergrad at Cambridge University. Caroline has had a handful of controversies surrounding her in the past few years, originating with a tell-all essay about her in New York Magazine, written by her former friend and ghostwriter.
Okay, here we go. So can you introduce yourself for my listeners who've never heard of you?
So I'm a criminal that's not in jail is like sort of my whole thing. Like Anna Delvey, Elizabeth Holmes, Billy McFarland, like what makes me different from them is I didn't get caught and I'm out here in the real world. I'm making jokes about the most recent thing that I went viral for was being a scammer. And before that, it was for being a fairy tale. So I've had many lives on the internet. And the current one now is sort of like downtown anti-hero. I think scammer is sort of my most previous chapter, but I'm really just a deeply, extremely online person who's very bougie, very openly elitist, boarding school, Cambridge University in England, studied art history, and now I make paintings and I have an OnlyFans and I'm just generally the patron saint of chaotic good.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I kind of want to walk it back. So will you tell me a little bit about like where you're from, what your upbringing was like, what was like baby
yes.
Caroline like?
So I'm from Falls Church, Virginia, which is like if anyone who's listening has ever seen Parks and Recreation, it's very much like people think of the suburbs of DC as being these places with sweeping green lawns and white patrician columns and azalea bushes the color of Valentine's. And they're right. Those places very much exist for the politicians and their dogs and their wives and children to live in. But I lived in like the place where like all the Starbucks and like the Blockbusters and the Borders and Barnes and Nobles were like next to those suburbs, sort of on Parks and Rec. I would live in Pawnee next to the surrounding Eagletons. And I really hated it. It was so boring. I always wanted to be famous. I always wanted to be a famous writer. I left and never looked back.
Do you keep in touch with anyone from your hometown?
Oh, no. I grew – one of the reasons I'm actually, like, so friendly and warm is my first claim to fame was I was the youngest person in the history of the world to have both kneecaps surgically removed. I was born with this extremely rare, like, 1 in 7 billion congenital defect. Your kneecaps are the only bone in your body that you're not born with. They develop into cartilage when you're a toddler and then ossify into bone around puberty. And for whatever fucking reason, my personal genetic DNA code told my cells to make those little discs of cartilage when I was a toddler and then just stop. They were like, we're done. To just keep those toddler-sized discs of cartilage. So I had to have both kneecaps removed and it was such an invasive surgery that I had to do like one leg at a time. So what I'm getting at is that I was the girl on crutches / a wheelchair. And at one point, I kid you fucking not, an actual old person walker with like, you know, like pierced tennis balls on the end of it.
And that's how you learn to walk?
No, that's how I learned to be nice to people. Because when you're like, do you keep in touch with anyone from Falls Church? It's like, no one wanted to talk to me in school because I was like, I was literally like, I also had braces for 6 years and I just like was so deeply, and on top of that, I'm such a chaotic weirdo. So like, you can imagine how well I did not fit in. My parents sent me to a really nice private school that was 45 minutes away from my house, but in those nice sort of Eagleton politician suburbs of DC. And yeah, I did not fit in with those kids at all. And I not only relearned how to walk, but I learned how to be very empathetic. So all for the best.
So when did you move to New York? So will you talk a little bit about that?
So one of the best things about me is that I'm deeply persistent. And I, after boarding school, I really wanted to go to Cambridge, but Cambridge did not want me to go there. They were like, we'll pass on this. And so I took a gap year and applied again. And again, Cambridge was like, it's a no from us, dog. And so then I had to start going to college because I didn't know what else to do with my life. Instagram hadn't been invented yet. Like I just had to start school. So I started at NYU. And for the first year, I just sort of like was Hermione Granger without the time turner. And I took a class and a half over the course limit. I was elected president of like CAS, which is like the biggest school at NYU, and had like just a crazy ass GPA. Like I just worked really, really hard. And then I applied again to Cambridge the third time and got in. So I had my home base in New York during all 3 years of my undergraduate degree at Cambridge. And then I'd sold a book by that point. And then I moved back to New York.
Okay, so one of your claim to fame is this New York Mag article. So I just want to briefly mention it. I'm sure you've gone over it a million times in interviews.
But I'm
so
like, what New York Mag article? Yeah. I've never heard of it.
So your former best friend, social media ghostwriter, wrote this tell-all article in the New York Mag about you. And it was a very damning article, if I may say so myself. And I just want to know initially.
Why did you think it was damning?
Well, initially when you read it, how did it make you feel?
Oh, I was like, this bitch is evil. It's me. I'm that bitch. No, like there are two elements that I really hate. And the first one is that she really took credit for building my brand. She really sort of very effectively attacked me with these sexist stereotypes of like women who are extremely online, women who are pretty, women who are popular, women who have large Instagram followings, they can't also be smart. Like, even though I was literally getting an undergrad degree at Cambridge, it was very much like, without me, she couldn't have built this. And I think a lot of people obviously don't understand the timeline because she did a really good job sort of zooming over this. Because I started my Instagram career by buying 40,000 followers mm-hmm. and wrote these jokes with Natalie. That was my, at the time, sophomore year at NYU. And then I transferred to Cambridge and we basically fall out of touch for 3 years while alone I write the captions, the long fairy tale captions that actually ended up building my brand. I mean, Natalie never responded to comments. Natalie never made Snapchat stories. Natalie never just did a million billion little minutes of interacting with fans that added up to hours, that added up to days, that added up to years, that added up to a community. I build this thing and sort of like ripen this fruit for harvest in terms of like leveraging that audience that is now 500,000 real people plus 40,000 fake followers into a book deal. Unfortunately, in the process through all this, my mental health has just, I've always struggled. Deteriorated. My whole life, I've struggled with suicidal depression that I inherited from my father. And at that time in my life, in my early 20s, I was self-medicating with, did you know I was addicted to Adderall, or is this going to be like new information for you?
No, I did know that. And I want to get into that.
I took it at first just to keep up with my studies. I mean, it was such a demanding workload during those 3 years at Cambridge. I was literally trying to build a brand on Instagram, you know, have friends, have a boyfriend, and get a degree from Cambridge. And I was doing it all while like not really like enjoying being alive at all. Like it was just like hard to get out of bed, as it has always been. But it got even harder as the pressures in my life increased so much more. And so I started taking Adderall to study, but I found that the euphoric upness of Adderall could actually be I want to choose my words carefully here because I don't want to sound like I'm endorsing this. Like, let me be clear. Do not self-medicate depression with Adderall. It will catch up to you. And although it seems it works at first, those years ended up being so much darker because of the way I was just like, at one point, my biggest problem with Adderall was that I did not know enough drug dealers in New York from whence to source it. Like, when you run out of, when your problem is not that you're spending too much money on it, like, I had made the money with the book deal. Like, I just couldn't get enough of this drug. I would stay up for 2-3 days at a time. Like, I didn't even want to, like, be with anyone. I just wanted to be left alone with the feeling of that high. But so that's senior year. We're at this place where I'm not yet at a place where I'm running out of drug dealers to buy from, but I don't have enough money to support my Adderall addiction. And I've just found out that my dad has, although he's always sent me to private schools, it turns out that he's gone deeply into debt. And my money does not have $30,000 for Cambridge tuition for my senior year. And my dad, because this sounds like, it's like, why didn't he just tell you? My dad just wasn't communicative in this way, especially as he started to, like, deteriorate, which he was at this point, into a way where, like, you couldn't have normal conversations with him. He was just really paranoid, really, really all over the place. And so I find out that my family doesn't have money for tuition 1 month into school my senior year. In, like, October, I literally just, like, get an email from the bursar's office that's like, hey, like, where's our $30,000? Like, you've been at school for a month. Like, very kindly pay tuition or not be at school. Like,
what did,
like,
you do?
Pick one. So I called up Natalie and I was like, we need to fucking crank out this book proposal. Like, I need your help. And so then we co-wrote this book proposal. Again, split it 50-50, right down the middle. And we sold this book proposal for $500,000, and of which I got $100,000 up front, and I gave $20,000 of that to Natalie. And Natalie does a very good job in her piece focusing on when we wrote those captions for the audience of 40,000 bots, zooming over the 3 years, and then focusing the reader's attention on when we co-write this book proposal. So I think a lot of people find that article very damning because it's like, look, you didn't even build this thing. Someone else built it for you and you took credit. But on top of that, as Natalie would later come to find out, I was incredibly addicted to Adderall. In fact, what makes this story kind of complicated and her betrayal all that more fucked up is, like, she was the first person, she helped me call therapist. She was the first person who told me, like, this is an addiction. Like, you have depression. Like, I think it might run in your family. Like stuff about your dad is really alarming. Like, she helped get me into therapy and had the first conversations in my life that were really frank about mental illness. But
yeah, that none of that was mentioned in the article.
Exactly. So I've gone viral 3 times in my life. Once for being a fairy tale when I was at Cambridge, deeply addicted to Adderall and just trying to make it as a writer. Again, and each one has been increasingly big. I think virality and viral fame, it very much is an exponentially compounding effect. So, like, each time builds on the time before. Second time I went viral was as a scammer. I launched these creativity workshops, which were
that people paid very chaotic. No, I was saying that people paid for, but then they never actually happened, correct?
No, not at all. No, the whole tour happened. Everyone who came to the events loved them. Everyone who was on Twitter who was never going to buy a ticket in the first place thought it was the stupidest, most overpriced thing in the world. Six hours for $165 to hang out with this random white girl and sit on the floor and, like, plant wildflower seeds in mason jars. They were just like, make it make sense. And to make things worse, the first workshop happened the day that Hulu and Netflix launched their Fyre Festival documentaries. So this comparison of like this influencer is the one woman Fyre Festival went absolutely viral. The biggest thing I had going for me at that time was that I was not running a scam and that I had made a niche event for a niche community that everyone who was attending it really enjoyed. So I invited all these reporters to the events, which kept happening. And because I thought, you know, at least they'll see that like everyone there is happy. And to this day, something I'm very proud of is that if you go back to January 2019 and like read the articles about me, yes, all the titles are "This woman is the one woman Fyre Festival." But if you read the fucking articles, everyone they quoted at the event was like, "This is the best day of my life. Money well spent." And I just like, I just think it's such, I mean, I don't know. It is what it is. I'm not that fed up about it anymore, but it was very frustrating and confusing and traumatizing and disorienting to go through at the time. But anyways, so I go viral for that. Meanwhile, in LA, Natalie reaches out to The Cut and she pitches them, like they were not contacting her, a tell-all for $5,000 being like, "Let me tell you like just how bad she is." And a week before it comes out, she emails me to be like, "Just so you know, this is coming out in The Cut. Like, I'm really glad like you're over your addiction. I'm so glad you've gotten help for your depression. Like, I'm so glad you're no longer addicted." Like, she uses these addict, addiction, addicted, depression, mental health. And the email was like 2-3 paragraphs long. If you've read The Cut article, this is longer than almost any essay I've ever submitted for school. It's like 5,000 fucking words. It's a long ass essay. And in this essay, she does not once use the word addiction, addict, addicted, mental health, depression. And I don't think people realize what a fucking double standard this is until you make the same comparison to a physical disease. If I wrote an essay for New York Magazine about my mom's cancer and presented the symptoms of her physical illness, you know, fatigue, exhaustion, if I presented them as character flaws like laziness or apathy towards her daughter, like disinterest in mothering, and then never at any point in the article used the name of the disease, cancer, like that would be unconscionable. They'd be like, you can't just do this. You have to like tell the reader she had cancer. But because mental illness is so stigmatized and more than anything invisible in our culture and so under-discussed and so taboo, no one blinked a fucking eye when Natalie just made me out to be, you know, this really sexist stereotype of like spoiled, dumb, mean girl. And what makes it even crazier is Natalie grew up richer than I did. Like, I've been to her house several times in New Haven, parents, both writers. Sister went to Brown. She very much was born into the world that I worked like tooth and nail to lift myself up into with my education. And that's my Natalie spiel. End scene.
Yeah, that's clearing up or your side of the story. Well, I'm glad you shared that. And I think you brought up a lot of points that I kind of want to dive into a little more deeply, starting with the Adderall addiction. Do you feel like, well, what made you first publicly even acknowledge the addiction as opposed to kind of dealing with it privately? I know your whole persona is online and we can get into that too.
Yeah, I think I don't often like speak about this because honestly, most people don't, it never comes up. Most people forget this part of my life ever happened. But so the year I spent after graduation in Cambridge was like rock bottom of my addiction. And it wasn't until like the following summer or so that I finally got clean. I got out of my book deal. I wish I could say I did it gracefully by like, you know, keeping everyone informed of my like deteriorating health and desire to get better. But I did it by lying to everyone, saying, "Oh, it's going really well. The book's going so well. It's going to be finished so soon." And then literally waking up one day and being like, "I sold a book I don't want to write. I'm not doing this." And that was the day I quit Adderall. And for the next couple of months, I was very much online. But I would say, and this is again, like I always feel like I have to be so careful drawing a line between discussing the truth of what has happened to me and like advocating others do what I'm doing. And like, this is very much like, don't try this at home. Like, this is just what the truth of what happened. I was basically just like drunk for the first 3 months of amphetamine sobriety. Like, I know that's not what people usually recommend for quitting a drug, is just do like a shit, replace it with a shit ton of another drug. But that is most certainly what I did. And after I stopped drinking so much, and because it took like 3 months for like the withdrawal feelings to like really stop. Like, do you know that sinking feeling you get when you get like a bad email where your heart just drops?
Yeah.
For me, amphetamine withdrawal felt like, it's almost like that feeling before an actual feeling settles in, like, you know, disappointment or guilt or sadness or like whatever this bad message is about to bring up for you. It truly felt like that falling, sinking, freewheeling feeling for just like 3 months. And I just felt like emotionally and psychologically, I just like couldn't land anywhere. I was just like, had this horrible sinking feeling. And so once that finally went away, then I stopped drinking so much and I spent the next 2 years offline. I maybe put up 15 grid posts.
In a two-year span
and the occasional story.
Do you feel like that had positive effects on your mental health, being off? I went offline for 6 months. I had no phone, literally none. No access to internet when I was in treatment. And it was just such a relief to wake up in the morning and feel like I don't have – I'm not existing on these platforms. Like, I'm really just in the present, in my body, tangible, in person. I'm here. Nothing's going on while my phone is down.
Do you mind if I ask you what you were in treatment for? Or it's okay if you don't want to say.
Just like having horrible, like debilitating anxiety. I was in a super toxic relationship. And just as that fully dwindled down, the only way I could really step out of it and step away was to go to treatment. And yeah, just being suicidal, such debilitating anxiety, like not eating, not sleeping, not functioning, not being able to make it to work, to do my emails, just like literally to the point where I was not a functioning person. So I actually chose to go. I had a lot of people close to me telling me like, oh, you don't really have to go to like a whole program, just see your therapist. But I knew it's what I needed. And as someone who appeared really high functioning, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm really glad I went. But I took 5 to 6 months completely with no phone.
Wow.
And as someone who's also existed online for almost 10 years, it was the first time in my life I'd been off for that long. So I'm wondering, in your 2 year experience where you weren't online as much, what were the effects for you? Did you feel different?
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing sounds so beautiful and healthy, and I really identify with it more now that I used to feel so weird about even taking like 2 days off from posting or like doing a story. Because, you know, my only experiences had been like doing it in Cambridge where I was just like destroying myself to like keep the engine moving of my brand online. And then my 2 years, honestly, when I didn't post, they were hell. I love posting online. And I think a big distinction, it might have been easier had someone just taken my phone away from me for 2 years, but I had the distinctly torturous experience of still being able to use my phone as a portal into everyone else's life online. And it was really, really hard for me when I was, because I was working through all this shame around my addiction, because you have to remember that like during these 2 years, this is before I've gone viral as a scam, this is before Natalie sold me out to the cut. At this point in time, the only record of me online is of like the luckiest girl in the world who has the best life ever. It was like 2015, 2016. Everyone's like, goals, 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 because that's what we said then. And so I just felt this, I didn't know how to be online. I felt this enormous shame about, like, you know, lying to my friends about being a bad friend, which, you know, everything in Natalie's article is true. She doesn't tell any lies. The only way she lies is by omission, by leaving out, you know, the full context of where that behavior was coming from. And also, but at the same time, who am I to throw the first stone? I literally sold a memoir to publishers where I didn't lie about going to Cambridge or going to balls. Like, I went, it happened. The only way I lied to them was by omission, by leaving out all the darkness.
It was selective storytelling.
Yeah. The 2 years was hard when I had my phone, because I felt like all my friends who had been online with me were, they were growing, they were surpassing me. I felt like I was being left behind.
Yeah. Do you feel that constant kind of keeping up? I imagine, and I definitely felt this when I had to leave my phone behind, of like, are people going to forget about me?
Am I forgettable? Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
If I'm not feeding the machine, to use your own words, yeah, and keeping up with this persona, this identity online.
Also, a little iced coffee ASMR for the pod. Just doing a little drugs on the pod, my new upper of choice, caffeine.
Yeah, I mean, do you worry about that even still?
I don't worry about that as much anymore, but only because I've been through absolute fire when it comes to staying relevant online. Like, when I went viral as a scammer, as like the One Woman Fire Festival, it was then that I learned that you cannot fight the currents of virality. Like, it's really like surviving going viral in a bad way. Same rules as surviving a riptide. If you try to fight the current,
I love this quote of yours.
Yeah. You'll expend all your energy too soon, too quick, and drown. You need to let it carry you in the direction it's going. And when the current subsides, swim back safely to shore. And that is not what I did the first time. I was like, I tried apologizing. I tried refunding. Oh, do you know what's so fucking crazy? Not only did the events continue, I did the rest of the tour for free and lost like $10,000. If anything, I scammed myself. Like, I literally just like, because I felt so worthless and I felt so bad and I felt like I had nothing to offer. And the later events, I ended up charging tickets. But for the first ones, I literally like gave everyone their money back and was like, pay what you want. Like, I just, if you feel scammed, I'm so sorry. And like, so many people sent their money back to be like, no, I had the best day ever. But I don't worry about being forgotten now, because when Natalie's thing came out, when I got that email from her being like, just so you know, next week this piece is coming, after I got that email, all I wanted to do was just, you know, go to sleep for the next 6 months until this whole thing would have blown over. But I knew that the only way that I could really like learn my lesson from the first time I went viral is if I just, you know, followed my own goddamn advice and like swam in the direction this wave was carrying me. I think, you know, it's so funny how often people talk about like Natalie's highly anticipated article for The Cut, everyone waiting for it on Twitter. It makes me sort of like smile in a bittersweet way, because they talk about that hype as if it's Natalie's accomplishment or New York Magazine's accomplishment. It is not. No. New York Magazine does not announce articles beforehand. Natalie had no presence online from which to talk about this article. I promoed the fucking shit out of this article in every single day. I cleared all other topics from my channel. Like, I just became a Natalie article countdown account, because I knew that I needed to hype this. And, you know, it is a beautifully written article. It's not particularly ethical, but it's very tightly worded. And, you know, it's extremely compelling. Like, the bigger villain she made me, the more enticed she makes a reader. I mean, we see it in superhero movies all the time. People like clear cut ideas of good and bad, and it takes a lot of brain power to grapple with the complexity of real human people. Whereas it's very easy to consume simple stories of good and bad. And, you know, I really leaned into that scammer title and having gone through that, I now really feel like, you know what, like anything that happened to me, like I'd be able to figure it out. Yeah. And there's a great saying that, you know, like a smooth sea never made a skilled sailor. Like you don't know how to really sail until you've been in rough oceans. And so at this point, I really don't worry about being forgotten at all, because I'm like, I don't know the right sailing term for this. I'm a black belt karate jiu-jitsu sailing master. A lot of mixed metaphors in this sentence. But yeah, I just feel like, yeah, that's one skill I probably have.
You can put it at the top of your resume.
Yeah, I'm just like good at playing the internet like a fucking church organ. That's the whole resume.
Do you have any advice for someone who's listening who has dealt with or is dealing with kind of internet trolls? You know, you can talk about how you can manage the waves, but how do you do that? Or what would you say to someone who's maybe not managing it as well?
I would say it's important to remember that everyone has them. I think it's really easy to feel alone in your trolling, because trolling is often so hyper-specific. It's a really specific thing that you've said or done or worn or just whatever that they're picking apart. So it feels really like you specific. But something that's been really peaceful for me to realize is I really used to walk around with this mentality that like I got trolled so much worse than other people. And, you know, I don't think it's a binary. I don't think it's like either that's true or we're all the same. I do think I get trolled a little bit more than most people. I mean, like, show me a Reddit page as obsessed with someone as D-list famous as I am, and like I will Venmo you $5, because it's just it's a lot for someone who's not that – I'm not that famous yet. But I would say, as I've met more famous people, like actual famous people over like the past year, it's been so fucking comforting for me to just have these private conversations behind the scenes where like they're literally just as bothered by it. It's sometimes even more than I am. And like everyone's getting it, even people who you think are like fucking perfect. So that would be the first thing I would say, remember everyone's getting it. And then I'd also say, just remember that these people are fucking sick. Like, it's really like, if I ever found out that one of my good friends in real life, if I like found out that they'd been sending like strangers on the internet, like people they do not know, abusive messages, I would remove that person from my life. I'd be like, oh my God, you're a psychopath. Like, you're literally so fucking weird. Like, what? Like, anyone who you'd actually want advice from, any of your accomplished, thriving, successful friends, they're not doing that. And I want my feedback from those people, and also people who actually have like fucking met me and like fucking know me. So I would say remember that those people are sick, and remember even the gods among us get trolled.
Well, do you think the issue is that those people are sick, or that it's so removed that they can say it behind screens, they don't have to say it to your face, and so it's more of a cultural component of like the times that we're living in?
It's for sure both. I mean, like, even in art history, like, people have always been meaner behind a paintbrush, behind a pen, whether it's like political caricatures or, you know, when print was invented, you know, writing scathing things about other people, that distance has always psychologically emboldened criticism. But I do think to compare someone who's been able to like carve out a livelihood of being a critic and to compare them to someone who literally like creates hundreds and hundreds of fake accounts to like keep coming back to one person to just privately send them one message. This is not in order to build them a career. This is coming at the detriment to their ability to like have their own friends, live their own life, go on their own dates, make their own money, have their own job. And that is what I say is like a sickness or like, I think it's kind to call, I think, you know, I could trivialize and be like, they're obsessed with me. But I think these people are truly like sick and need serious help. as, and there's nothing wrong with that. I used to go to therapy 3 times a week. I go twice now, but like, I'm very open to having to go back to 3 times a week or 4 times a week. Like, I've made peace with the fact that I have a brain that skews towards suicide. And a lot of people consider therapy a luxury, but if I were born with a faulty kidney, I wouldn't blink twice at the idea of paying for weekly or monthly dialysis or whatever I needed to like keep that organ functioning at tip top condition. But to answer your question, I think it's both and. It's screens embolden people, distance emboldens people, not having to actually hurt people emboldens people. And when you really get into the people who are like on those Reddit threads on the daily, that is like a kind of sickness.
So I have dealt with some really wild trolling.
Oh my God, tell me.
Let's see, one of the craziest ones. I had someone make over 200 accounts in a 6-month span that got increasingly more threatening. And every time I would block them, they would just make another account. To the point where they were sending me my address saying I was going to get murdered.
Wow.
They then made the whole account actually followed everyone I followed. So then people would look at this, spewing kind of false information about me. And they said that they were actually a real friend of mine in real life. But they weren't actually. Basement dweller.
How did you find out that it was a random basement dweller? Besides the fact that obviously it was.
This has got to be back in like 2016, 2015, where I feel like laws just weren't keeping up with the times, you know? So
I still don't think they're keeping up with the times.
I did go to the police just because I was getting threats. And it took like 4 to 5 months for Facebook, who owns Instagram, to give up the IP address of the person. I never pressed charges. I just wanted to know who it was and if I was safe. And yeah, it was some random girl who lived in a state many states away from where I lived.
I relate to everything you're fucking saying. I would say like once every 2 years, the Reddit will like dox my address. Reddit, thankfully, has like good on that site for really cracking down on doing that. I think they just like can tell now when posts contain an address because my team has always like gotten it taken down quite quickly. And we have a contact there now who like we can contact about keeping me safe because it's like such a problem. But in terms of, I get messages all the time being like, I know you in real life. You think I'm your friend, but I'm not. And I think this and this and this about you. Messages also like, I'm watching you right now. Like, I see you out. And the only reason I know that these are like not true is because occasionally I'll get them in places where I'm definitely not. But sometimes like, I mean, I don't like really travel in that far of a radius from the West Village. So when people are like, I see you in the West Village, like,
Alarm bells go off.
I know it's not true, but like it also doesn't feel great to get that message. It doesn't feel awesome. Of people, I've definitely gotten death threats. I think a lot of people, once I came out, maybe that's not the right word, although in our culture, which so stigmatizes mental health, it almost feels like a big reveal of some sort that's taboo. But once I revealed to people that I was had struggled with suicidal depression and that my dad had killed himself with an overdose of painkillers.
I'm sorry about that.
I get a lot of death threats that are not like, I'm going to kill you, but it's like, your dad killed himself because he was so ashamed of you. Or like, you should – good thing you have depression. Like, I hope you kill yourself and rid the world of you. And then the craziest thing my community has ever done, and I never went to the police. I don't even know. It's actually really inspiring that you went to the police. Tell me if you think that there are any laws being broken here that like you think I could do something about. But after my dad's death, the Reddit community kept sending me messages that he was still alive. They're like, I just talked to him on the phone. He's not dead. That was crazy.
See, that's deranged. And then, That's kind of what what my stalker person would do, because my mom passed away when I was young, and they found photos of her, and they would send them to me in the DM to like get my attention, so I would read their messages. And I remember just like the feeling you described earlier of like getting a bad email, just like such a physical feeling when I would read this stuff.
Such a physical thing.
I want to know what your opinion is on people who are listening to this podcast, that are listening to both of us talk about kind of our experiences getting trolled, and people who view us as more one-dimensional, like privileged white women who gives a fuck if they get trolled. Like when the humanity exits the chat and it's like, wait, at the end of the day, we're people too, and we have emotions and feelings, and it's painful getting those messages.
I would feel bad for those people, because, you know, we are privileged, and they're also, we're also both women. Men are more privileged than us. White men are not as privileged as the richest white men in the world, like Elon Musk are the most powerful ones. And, you know, I think there's always, until you get to the very top of the pyramid, there are going to be people who have it better than you. But I don't think just because they're people who have it better off than me for the, you know, the body that they were born into, the family they were born into, the world that they're born into, I still wouldn't wish this trolling on them. Like, I don't see that as an excuse. Like, if I can look at people with more privilege than me and not wish ill on them, or like think that like they deserve it, I think it throws into pretty harsh relief how fucked up it is for anyone to look at us and be like, oh, they deserve it. Like, no, get a soul, grow up. That's a toxic way to look at the world.
Do you feel like reading any of that stuff and having gone viral multiple times and experienced all your the spectrum of getting trolled, do you ever start to believe what people are telling you? You know, kind of the idea of like, if everyone thinks you're an asshole, you start believing you're an asshole.
Yeah, I often say this, that it was very hard to hold on to the idea of myself as good when the whole world thought I was bad. And I've never found a better way to express that concept than that single sentence. And it was really hard. The hardest was – the two points that were the hardest was when I was at before there was a Reddit about me, there was a private Facebook group picking apart every single thing about me. The first time I discovered this Facebook group, this was like during the fairy tale days at Cambridge, it absolutely wrecked me to go from thinking that there were just like some people who didn't like my account or would leave an occasional mean comment, to realize that there was a organized group of people who every time I did anything were going to be there to pick it apart, whether it was just, you know, anything, what I was reading, what I was wearing, what my face looked like, what my hair looked like, what I said, what I misspelled, what font color I chose, anything. That absolutely wrecked me. I was like literally incapacitated for like 1 week with grief. And then the next big jump was when I went viral as like the Fyre Festival scam. And that I really, like, for the first week of that onslaught of going viral as a scammer, I absolutely believed it, especially because it was coming from, I sort of have a better relationship with journalists now, but before I went viral as a Fyre Festival criminal, I loved journalists. Like, I was like, these are my people, my fellow writers, artists, you know? Like, and then reading those articles where, you know, the title's trashing me, but all the like quotes from the people at the event are like positive, it really made me see like how click driven journalism can be. Like, it's not always as much of a writing based art form that I had held it up to be in my mind. So but it was also really hard because I had sort of cherished journalism until then. And to like see myself in the news, these places where that I'd like this source of information that I'd once trusted. Yeah, that was really hard. And basically what I'm trying to say is that, like, yes, I have believed it, but I think it's easiest to believe it when you do like a big jump in the volume of trolling that you're getting. Like, you know, the day I went from thinking there was no community talking about me in a Facebook group to like reading that Facebook group.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
Like, have you ever had a moment where you're like, holy shit, why do these people care? Or like, why are they so obsessed with me?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that all the time.
Do you think of yourself as famous?
Absolutely. But not as famous as I'd like to be.
But like, I wonder, so when I think about you, I think of this like fame in a certain niche online, like maybe someone just walking down the street, or if I were talking to my dad, they wouldn't have heard of you. But obviously a certain group of people are so obsessed with you, create these groups online on Reddit and all these places. I can imagine that can almost fragment someone's identity. And like, where do you lay between that? Like, who is the real Caroline Calloway? We'll end on that.
I mean, the real Caroline Calloway is obviously me living my life. And I know I share more than 99% of everyone else online, but that does not mean that I'm sharing 100% of what happens to me. Like, there are lots of, I have a rule for myself that I don't share about anything that I'm not fully healed from. And so there are lots of things that I privately process with my therapist, with my friends, with my mom, my grandma. And like, that's very much the real Caroline Calloway. But I also, I used to try to make my online persona the person I wanted to be. And now I really try to make my online persona ever catching up to the like person that I'm changing into and evolving into, which, you know, for everyone is dynamic and shifting all the time, with that one caveat of like, if I'm not privately healed from it, then I'm not, you know, it's not compulsory to share it. And in terms of like, you know, you think of me being like niche famous, I really don't think of the Reddit as like having anything to do with my fame. I think of myself as very New York coastal elite famous, which if I had to choose one area of the world to be famous in, it would absolutely be that again and again. And I think what I'd like to become more of is sort of like a cultural, when I say that I think I'm famous, I think people say my name and they mean something very specific. They mean Cambridge, they mean scammer, they mean online persona, they mean turquoise and flowers and like chaos. And I think that is, that's what I mean when I say I'm famous, not the Reddit thing.
And no, I didn't mean just the Reddit group. I just mean that maybe walking down the street, it's not like an Angelina Jolie, you know, it's not that level, that volume.
No. I wish. No, it's not like that at all. I only get recognized like maybe once every other day and only in New York. It did not happen to me fucking once in Florida.
Do you have any like kind of last questions or do you feel good with that?
I feel great with this. No more last questions. Let's say goodbye. My assistants are ready to work and being very quiet in the corner, which I feel very bad about. So I need to go talk to them and go scam some unsuspecting innocents and not get caught.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
And thank you so much for having me.